of the day, the United States versus Harris. Mr. McKinley?
May it please the court, good morning. James McKinley representing Anthony Harris. You may recall on our last trip here, this court remanded the case for a Franks hearing, and that Franks hearing was conducted in January of this year. And it was during the course of that hearing that we heard from the police officer who testified that the confidential informant, upon whose reports probable cause is based, had reportedly visited the residence of my client and observed my client, Anthony Harris, and his brother, Trent Harris, dealing drugs. Not once on April 12th, a week before the warrant application was submitted, but twice, once on April 12th and again on April 18th, which was the day before the warrant application was made. Mr. Harris's complaint here is that the police officer got a third bite at the probable cause apple. His first opportunity was in the original warrant application, wherein he represented that the confidential informant had been in the residence within 72 hours of the warrant application.
I know you call it a third bite, but let's get to the issue here. I mean, the whole reason it was sent back was so there could be a Franks hearing and to look at the affidavit to see if there were recklessly made false statements. So wasn't the district court just doing what this court asked it to do?
Your Honor?
The district court just doing what this court asked it to do. You're talking about a third bite. We sent it back for the district court to review it.
Right. We got exactly what we asked for. Mm-hmm. However, we disagreed that the court should entertain new evidence on the issue, and an issue that's already been decided. That is, previously the district court found and concluded that the confidential informant had only been at the residence one time, a week before the probable cause affidavit, and that the representation in the original warrant application was intentionally or recklessly misleading and designed to mislead the judge who issued the warrant originally. We argued unsuccessfully that the law of the case doctrine should preclude reconsideration of that, basically that the officer's original claim of a visit on April 18th was, again, an intentional reckless misrepresentation designed to deceive the court.
In order for the court to make that determination, though, of whether it was reckless, doesn't the court have to look at all the facts that are presented? And of necessity,
well, the original finding,
additional evidence that might be presented on the question.
Well, we, of course, understand, Your Honor, that law of the case doctrine is not an absolute bar. This is a discretionary issue for the district judge. I'll concede that. I acknowledge that. Nonetheless, it's not a principle that ought to be, you know, shrugged aside lightly or disregarded absent some compelling justification for revisiting that issue which had already been decided. The only justification here offered by the government was basically an apology that they didn't get the job done right the first time. And, of course, recognize that this issue is going to be reviewed for abuse of discretion. This court may have some reluctance to question that exercise of discretion. But if that's the case, we're still left with the bigger problem, the more troubling aspect of this case that we've questioned in good faith since the beginning. And that is, does this informant even exist? Or is this informant a fabrication on the part of the police officer who deliberately falsified allegations of probable cause, knowing that the informant's privilege would serve to conceal that ploy? My client has steadfastly maintained he was not at that house within 72 hours. I don't know whether he was there. No one in this courtroom knows whether he was there or whether the CI was there. And I think it should give this court great pause simply to defer to the district court's conclusion about whether he was there on April 18th, because the court has taken no additional steps to corroborate or verify this assertion. Now, the government's brief, you know, devotes considerable attention and discussion to the informant's privilege. And we're, of course, you know, sensitive to the competing considerations there. But at this point, we are not asking, and really have not asked, for them to disclose the identifiers of this informant. What we're asking, what we asked the court simply to do, was to take a step to confirm that an informant indeed exists. And that can be done by the simple use of an ex parte hearing in which the informant could be produced, or some documentation reflecting that there was a relationship. Because there is this one undisputed fact that continues to linger here, and that is that the police officer says that he saw my client and Trent Harris at that house. We know that Trent Harris was in jail at the time. He could not have seen Trent Harris at the house. The CI purportedly also saw my client and Trent Harris at this house at a time when Trent Harris was jailed. This whole notion that the police officer and the informant both mistakenly identified the man with my client as Trent Harris is a very suspicious coincidence. And it's a coincidence that I believe renders the entire warrant suspect. And accordingly, we'd ask this court to remand this case one more time, directing the court to, at a minimum, conduct an in-camera proceeding to verify the existence of this informant, or for any other proceedings consistent with what this court would conclude.
Thank you. Mr. McKinley. Mr. Minkler?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Josh Minkler, and I represent the United States of America in this case. This case was remanded for a Franks hearing, which is exactly what took place. After that Franks hearing, I believe Judge Barker and the government paid particular attention to one of the factors which this court was extremely troubled with, and that was the interval between the date of the events and the application of the warrant. This court referred to it as the temporal guidepost. That is a critical fact in this matter, and was explored extensively by the government at that Franks hearing, Judge Barker, and cross-examination by Mr. McKinley. In the affidavit originally submitted for this search warrant, the affiant, Detective Forrest, who was the witness at the Franks hearing, swore that within 72 hours of April 19th, the date that the warrant was applied for, the informant contacted Detective Fortas and told him he was personally within the residence, and told him he saw cocaine and was told by the defendant that cocaine was for sale. When he testified at the Franks hearing, he testified that that took place on April 18th, 2004, which was clearly within the 72-hour time window. When we were up here the first time, that fact was not clear. It has consistently been the government's position that the informant was in the house on April 18th, 2004. But certainly the first time, that was decided on the supplemental affidavits, which, as this court found and now is quite clear after having the hearing, was probably not the best way to do it. The best way to do it was to have a hearing and to have that hearing and to determine whether or not the informant was, in fact, in the house on April 18th, 2004. And after listening to that testimony, Judge Marker made a clear finding of fact that the informant was in the house on April 18th, 2004, and that he did, or he or she did, see cocaine, was told, at least by the defendant, that that cocaine was for sale. So on the issue of whether or not there's probable cause in this warrant, since the government has determined and has shown that there is this temporal guidepost, or that the interval between the date of the events and the application for the warrant is within the 72 hours, I would submit to the court that that does weigh in the government's favor of finding probable cause for the search warrant. As to the argument regarding the law of the case, I think this is clearly a situation where the law of the case doctrine should not be applied. When the first factual determinations were made, there was no hearing. There was really just the supplemental affidavits, which makes it kind of difficult, as we've seen, to make a correct determination of the facts. Now that we've had a full-blown hearing and everything's been explored, I would submit to the court that we have a more accurate finding and a finding that should not be reversed, and the law of the case doctrine should not apply. I would also submit to the court that in Harris 1, or the first opinion, this court said that the so-called good faith exception, the Leon good faith exception, should not apply if there's not probable cause. I think that ruling could be reexamined respectfully in this case as well. Judge Barker has now found, after having a full-blown Franks hearing, that there was not a false statement made by the affiant and not a statement made that was reckless, but rather, as to the brother, more of an honest mistake, and that the fact that the informant was in the house within 72 hours was actually an accurate statement. So even if there wasn't probable cause, this was a good faith application for a search warrant, and the good faith doctrine should apply. Briefly touching on the informant issue, as I understand Mr. Harris's argument, the informant quite simply does not exist, and the only way we can determine whether he exists or not is for some evidence to be provided that he does exist. Well, that was as well, I would submit to the court, one of the things that occurred at the Franks hearing, where the affiant, Detective Forrest, testified extensively, not just about his relationship with the informant on this case, but with his relationship with the informant on prior cases. And Judge Barker made a factual determination. It's in a footnote, but nonetheless it is a factual determination, that in fact the informant did exist and did have a relationship with Detective Forrest. So that's a factual determination that has been made, and I don't think it's a determination that's clearly erroneous. And moreover, as the government points out in its brief, and I won't go over this extensively, this informant is more analogous to a tipster. He is not an informant that participated in the execution of the search warrant, not an informant that participated in the crime, but one that provided information. And following the law, which has been provided in the Bender case, it is our position that the identity does not need to be revealed, and certainly is not relevant to the district court's determination of probable cause in this case. So with that being said, I would respectfully request this court to affirm Judge Barker's judgment after the second Franks hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mankler. Mr. McKinley?
Your Honor, I have nothing further to offer if the court does not have any questions.
Apparently not. Thank you. Thanks to